Facial recognition technology. It's everywhere and controversial. Do you have a smartphone that you can hold up to your face to unlock? Have you noticed that Facebook identifies friends to tag in group photos? These are two examples of facial recognition technology. And these examples are just the tip of the iceberg of how it's being used today. Law enforcement officers can use it to look for suspects in a crowded place, like a train station. Governments have used it to target dissidents. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Last month, Portland became the latest U.S. city to pass a law curtailing the use of facial recognition technology. And there's a bill pending in Congress to do the same. Today on Maine Calling, we will look at how it works and its potential benefits and drawbacks. That's next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm your host, Jennifer Rooks. We mostly hear about facial recognition technology in terms of its use by the police. Well, today we'll learn how this technology works, why it's controversial, and what its potential uses are. My guest, Michael Kubota, who is policy counsel with the ACLU of Maine, and Terry Yu, an associate professor of computer science at the University of Maine. We invite your comments and questions. Send an email, a brief email, to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you. And Terry, I'm going to start with you. We hear about facial recognition technology. Any of us who has a Facebook page has seen, if you put a group picture up, for example, that facial recognition technology can tell you who you know that's in that picture. How does it work? Is it like it seems in the movies and on TV, where like a little grid comes up in front of somebody's face and spits out matches?
Well, it does in fact work a great deal like that. Since about five years ago, there's been an enormous explosion in AI technologies and computer vision technologies, and largely driven by inexpensive computing power, but also just the enormous, cataract, the flood of data that that people have, the curated pictures that we have coming in, allowing us to line up different, statistically line up the different pictures of the same people. And that's been an enormous advantage to helping advance the algorithms, the technologies that we use to do face recognition.
So what you're saying is part of it is that the technology has advanced a great deal, but part of us is that all of us are putting pictures of ourselves on the internet, whether it's a LinkedIn page or Facebook or something else, and that powerful technology is able to link everything.
Yeah, the technology honestly has existed, or at least the ideas, the methods, the mathematics have existed for decades. But we have this confluence of you're carrying what we would have thought of 20 years ago as a supercomputer in your pocket, in your cell phone. And so that the advance in technology, but also all that technology would be worthless without data to work on it. And yes, you put your finger right on it. The number of pictures that people are posting, pictures of their dogs, their families, their children, everything else, is providing fodder, grist for this mill, if you like, but the ability to develop new and better ways to do computer vision, not just face recognition, dog recognition, plant recognition, mushroom recognition, all those things that we're seeing.
That's right. Well, Michael, I want to bring you into this conversation, and I want you to sort of go through a list of all the different ways that right now facial recognition technology is being used. I mentioned at the very beginning of the show, on Facebook to recognize people from photos. We know that when we have smartphones, the newer versions of the smartphones, the facial recognition technology will unlock that phone instead of your fingerprint. Also, obviously, police, law enforcement agencies around the world use it. But that's just the tip of the iceberg, right? How else is it being used?
Thank you for having me. Facial recognition is increasingly being used by law enforcement and by different government actors. It's being used in the United States and it's being used around the world. And it's misused by very powerful actors who, even without facial recognition, have abused their power, leads to the potential for massive violations of civil liberties.
So give us some examples. Tell us, for example, the best known is happening in China.
You're right. The best known, the most dystopian, is happening in China, where the government has been using facial recognition technology to track Uyghur Muslims and to round them up and throw them in re-education camps, where all kinds of horrific things happen. But here in the United States, facial recognition has led to many dystopian examples. In 2016, the Associated Press investigated the behavior of police officers toward databases of people who the state tracks, and uncovered lots of very disturbing things. For instance, in Ohio, just before 2016, a police officer pleaded guilty to stalking his ex-girlfriend, Alexis DeCaney. Many more examples of these. And facial recognition just makes that more likely and easier to do. Now, there are two major ways that facial recognition can lead to an erosion of our civil liberties. One is if it works well, and another is if it doesn't work well. If it works well, it enhances the power of law enforcement to misuse their power. Law enforcement are people, and just like people, they have love interests, and they have grudges against people, and they have exes who they might end up wanting to stalk. And law enforcement, just like the people in the general population, have been found guilty of these behaviors. Facial recognition just enhances their power to do that. It's also very dangerous if it doesn't work. And throughout the last few years, there have been some high-profile cases in which facial recognition has led to false positives of people associating a certain person with a crime that they haven't committed. I'll give you one example. In South Denver, Steve Talley, a couple of years ago, was picked up by police for an alleged bank robbery. He was later cleared of the charges, but he was identified as the suspect by facial recognition. And as a result of these charges, he lost his job and his kids.
I'm sorry, Michael, what year was this?
This was in the last couple of years.
Yeah. So on the other hand, though, there are times when facial recognition technology has been powerful, positive for police officers. I'm thinking about in England, the poisoning of Sergei Skripal. We all saw those, if we were watching the news at that time in history, we saw the suspects being able to be tracked down because England has cameras everywhere.
Well, what's interesting about that story is the poisoning didn't actually get stopped by facial recognition. Now, it's important for people who actually violate the right to life to be captured and to answer for what they've done. But our view is that in order for facial recognition to work, there has to be an enormous amount of data about each and every one of us stored, collated, and analyzed somewhere. And that level of power in the hands of government, in the hands of an institution that has, down the centuries, repeatedly abused its power, is too big of a danger to justify.
Terry, let me talk to you about some other uses. I know there was a big case this past year involving an organization called Clearview AI that harvested billions of photos of people from the internet without their permission. Clearview is not a government agency. It's not a law enforcement agency. What is it exactly, and why is a place called Clearview looking at photos across the internet?
Well, let me... Clearview is one of those examples of a technology development company that's trying to provide a service. But if you think about the kinds of data that other people are using, 23andMe, for instance, is collecting genomic data. And it has, nefarious uses as well as positive uses. And the social tension that comes about of applying new technologies like this, do you really want to know who your biological parents are or whether you still have biological relations out there? Maybe they don't want to be contacted. Those are all questions that come up when a new technology comes along. And honestly, the laws governing our technologies are always behind the types of technologies that get developed. Going back 100 years to the development of photography and recording or any of the other things, radio broadcast even, we're on the radio. It wasn't clear that libel laws that applied to print were originally going to be applied to broadcast media. And, we have to, as the technology comes along, we have to come up with the regulations, and society has to come up with where it draws the lines. In the absence of legal policy, organizations will take it upon themselves to provide what they hope is a service, a beneficial one, a profitable one for themselves. Picasa is a site that you load up your family photo album, and they'll help you organize it. But they'll do facial recognition to help you organize your Christmas photos and identify Aunt Sally and everybody else in those pictures. My mother-in-law just discovered this on her brand new iPad, that she can make photo books, and this is great. I don't even like scrapbooking, and now I have all these photo books. All my favorite nieces, nephews, grandchildren can be organized in photo books automatically. Isn't this wonderful? Well, yes, but if it's used to stalk people, it's not. Clearview AI is a company. It is a going concern. They're developing a technology which, as I said, they're hoping it will be beneficial, not necessarily nefarious. And they're hoping that it will be profitable for themselves in the end. But it's not clear to me that that the technology is at fault as opposed to we're just behind the curve on trying to figure out where do we draw the line as a society.
So your point, Terry, is that it's not the technology that's inherently good or inherently evil, but it's how we use it and whether government is quick enough, whether legislation is quick enough and thorough enough to regulate it properly.
I hate to be boxed in because I do have moral feelings about these things as well. But let me give you another example for how people use face recognition. Google and later the National Library of Medicine at the National Institutes of Health undertook a project called separately and independently, took a project called Lost Person Finder. In the event of a Katrina event or something where people are separated, if you imagine your mother-in-law was had dementia, could not actually tell people her name, and was separated from her health care staff from the facility she was in, and was bussed off to Metairie to the New Orleans airport, which is where they were staging people, how would you find where your grandmother-in-law was located? Well, the idea was that the healthcare providers, the emergency providers on site would take photographs of all the patients that were coming in, and they would put up a database, and they would use facial recognition to help you find where your loved ones were. If you think after a 9/11, that sort of thing could also have been amazingly powerful. No one would concern themselves if you used this for a lost pet finder, for instance, helping you find your lost dog. It's when we start talking about privacy, we talk about people's identities, that the problem becomes fraught.
Michael, and I think this is a big question here, is that if this is so omnipresent. Are cities passing laws about something as specific as law enforcement and using facial recognition technology in investigation? Is this really just sort of like paddling against a tsunami?
Absolutely not. We create the world through laws. We legislate the entire system that we live under into existence. The city of Portland is the most recent city, I believe, in the United States, Portland, Maine, to ban facial recognition technology by being used by law enforcement. That's a ban that is now enforceable by people whose civil liberties the government violates by using facial recognition. And that law will change the behavior of law enforcement in Portland. The fact that the Portland City Council did that makes Portland a safer place than if we had law enforcement using facial recognition. And part of the reason is that there are still, with the most of the existing algorithms that facial recognition technologies use, very high false positive rates, especially for Asian and African American people. The highest false positive rate identified by an FBI study last year was for Native Americans, confirming what the MIT researcher Joy Bulamini called algorithmic bias. And
what are the rates of false positives? You say the highest rates of false positives among these certain groups. What are those rates?
Up to 100 times more likely to misidentify Asian.
So is it one half, one tenth, one one hundredth? How many people out of 100 are likely to be misidentified?
Well, these rates are comparative. So the
I understand that you're saying they're comparative, yeah. But I'm wondering what they are.
I would have to go to the methodology section of the FBI study, which will take me a minute. But for every, each of these false positive rates is established against a benchmark of an accurate positive rate for white men. And even in the case of white men, as I said in the earlier story about Steve Talley, there are false positive rates that end up ruining people's lives.
Well, while you're finding that information, Terry, I want to ask you the question. You mentioned, you used the analogy of genomics, and one thing that we're learning with things like 23andMe is that the more people are a part of it, the more accurate they become, and that people who are from certain parts of the world have 5 years ago had very inexact findings, and the more information that's in there, the better their findings are. Is that the same thing with this, Terry? Will this technology become less biased or not really?
We hope that it's going to become less biased. Some of the technologies that we use, Michael mentioned that the people of color in particular there's a bias, or there are racial biases that can be introduced by a demographic. I remember that the Microsoft Kinect, which uses a infrared system, it projects infrared light into the room in order to track your gestures to try and control video games, originally didn't work with people of color. They hadn't tested it very carefully, and they had very different reflection detection rates from the infrared patterns that the Kinect projected into the room. So, and that presumably also applies to the Apple iPhone. The Apple iPhone, you mentioned yourself that some of our smartphones use Face ID, Apple ID, Face ID to do security, to let people unlock their applications on their phone. And the iPhone 10 and 11, whatever, after the iPhone 10, have been using the same technology, this structured light technology, where they project a pattern of infrared light from their phone, and then they record the image going back to get a 3D imprint of the person's face on the other line, other side of the camera. And if the infrared technology and the detection technology that works differently on people with different skin tone, then in fact, technology itself has a bias that has to be corrected.
All right. Well, we'll continue this discussion about the rates of false positives when we come back. In the meantime, we are talking about facial recognition technology. We'd love to have you join the conversation. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at MainCalling, or post a comment to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us MainCalling with help from Bull Moose, offering an option of curbside pickup on books, movies, CDs, or video games. Curbside pickup is available at checkout at bullmoose.com. And Green Lantern Solar, developing solar projects for landowners, schools, and businesses throughout Maine. GreenLanternSolar.com.
On the next Planet Money, the murderer, the boy king, and the invention of modern finance.
He killed a man in a duel, and then he escaped from prison. So you wouldn't have expected a great monetary economist to develop from such a figure.
And on How I Built This, a designer who began her 40-year career with an accidental splash of color. That's on the next Planet Money and How I Built This from NPR.
And that's coming up this evening at 10 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public's new All Books Considered Book Club connects readers across Maine. Our virtual book discussions are hosted by members of the Maine Calling team and feature an opportunity to hear directly from the author. We invite you to join us. For complete details on the book club, including our inaugural reading selection and how to sign up, please visit mainepublic.org and click on events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we're talking about how facial recognition technology works and how it's used. Joining me, Terry Yu, who is Associate Professor of Computer Science at UMaine. He teaches a graduate course on computer vision. And Michael Kubota, Policy Counsel with the ACLU of Maine. His focus is on civil rights. Share your comments or questions. Email talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Michael, I want to return to that question of false positives and see if you've been able to come up. I really want to have a sense of how often this happens, especially for people of color and, as you mentioned, Indigenous peoples.
Thank you. I have been trying to track down the FBI study and have only been able to find secondary sources. But let me read you a quote from the Washington Post, which I think is a relatively trustworthy paper. And here's what it says. Asian and African American people were up to 100 times more likely to be misidentified than white men, depending on the particular algorithm and type of search. Native Americans had the highest false positive rates of all ethnicities, according to the study, the FBI study, which found the systems vary widely in their accuracy.
All right. Well, we still don't know if we're talking about twice as much could be, it depends if we're talking about small numbers or large numbers. I'd love to know what that is. Are we talking 7 out of 10,000 or are we talking 700 out of 10,000? I'm going to go to Friedrichs calling from Milo. Hi, Friedrichs. Go ahead.
Hi. Just want to mention a positive to the false positive. Is I'm assuming that if I put a baseball cap on and wear a mask, that the facial recognition will not work. And so the positive is that people who do not want to take on a false positive will start wearing masks.
Yeah, so Terry, let's talk about that. We're living in a world right now where a lot of people are wearing masks. How is facial recognition technology affected by that?
Oh, it's either, as the caller says, it's a positive or a negative, depending on which side of the line you're on. I will say that one of the studies on one of the groups doing the most studies on face recognition include Dr. Jonathan Phillips's team at the National Institute for Standards and Technology at NIST. And one of their grand challenges that they ran some years ago was they were working on ear recognition. For exactly this rate, that people can use makeup or wear facial coverings, and they would do 3D scans of people's ears instead of their faces, and the detection rate on ear detection was actually quite high, considering you need to hear. You can wear headphones, I guess, but in general, I'm not suggesting that the technology is defeating a person's ability to protect their identity, but there are other biometrics you can do. Mission, for instance.
Interesting. Friedrich, thanks so much for your call. Michael, I want to ask you about the bill before Congress right now. What does it entail, and what are its chances of passing?
I would first like to respond to Friedrich's comment, actually,
sure.
About how you can evade face recognition by wearing a mask. I would hate to live in a society where I have to wear a mask. Let's say it's 100 degrees, and maybe we've all been vaccinated against COVID-19 by that time. I would hate to live in a country where I have to wear a mask to stay safe from the government. And so although you could probably cover your face with a ski mask and outsmart the facial recognition system in your society, that does strike me as gambling away too much for very, very little in return.
Okay, and what about the bill before Congress right now?
I can tell you about the bill. I would be overreaching my authority and knowledge to opine on its likelihood of passing. But I think you're referring to Senate Bill 847, and the Commercial Face Recognition Privacy Act of 2019. And so it would basically prohibit certain entities from collecting, processing, storing, or controlling face recognition data unless they do certain things. And these are the certain things. They have to provide documentation that explains the capacities and limits of their technology, and they have to get consent from us, from people in the public, before collecting our information, which may then be used for facial recognition. And then there are a few other restrictions on commercial facial recognition outfits that are in the bill.
Terry, I want to ask you, I understand that Amazon was among the funders of the trying to defeat a similar bill to Portland, Maine's and Portland, Oregon. Do you foresee if legislation is passed like that legislation before Congress, a day when to be able to use something like social media, you're just clicking that you understand that your face will be used? So many of us just click on these boxes that pop up as soon as we log into a new website, almost without thinking. Do you see that as part of our future?
It's unclear where this is going. YouTube recently announced their policy that they're banning routine facial recognition. You have to get permission from them, or they're trying to put bounds around this. Outright bans on the use of certain technologies comes at a cost, and it's a relatively blunt instrument when you're doing an outright ban, because other countries, other actors, bad actors, large, powerful actors, however they go, may continue to use those technologies. This may not be the right forum to take that up as to who should have the tools and who shouldn't, but the a ban is an outright ban, and a widespread ban, as I said, is a relatively blunt instrument. How to get more incisive on that is unclear to me. The statistic you're looking for, Jennifer, on false positives appears to come from a NIST study. I was mentioning NIST before, and Jonathan Phillips' team there. There are reports, the NIST report itself confirmed Michael's assertion that some of the algorithms were 100 times worse. But your question was, what are the actual false negative and false positive rates? And the false negative rate reported from the NIST data by a group called Information Technology Innovation Foundation lists the false negative, false positive rate, I just lost it, at 0.4. 0.49%, so about a half a percent or less for black females. So it gives you some numbers to say 10 times worse than that would give you, a 5% a false negative rate for black females, for instance. So these are I don't know if the statistic translates well, but
sure, that's helpful. And Michael, I understand that it's about more than the false positives, that you believe that this technology can lead to racial profiling and invasion of privacy. So why don't you talk about some of the broader concerns about the prevalence of and the future of facial recognition technology?
Sure. We in Maine are not immune from law enforcement abusing their power. The Northwoods Lawless scandal is relatively fresh in some of our minds. It's 4 years old. People have died in police custody and in the custody of corrections officers. The Fusion Center, which is an intelligence gathering and analysis center, has been shown to track environmental activists, Black Lives Matter activists, Seeds of Peace activists, and people working to stop the CMP corridor in
And the Fusion Center is run by the Maine State Police. Go on.
It is, yes. It's part of the Department of Public Safety. In Michigan, the 2016 Associated Press study that I referenced earlier, in Michigan, an officer found that an officer looked up the home addresses of women he found attractive. In Florida, two Miami officers ran checks on a journalist after the journalist aired unflattering stories about their police department. Here in Portland, earlier this year, a police officer showed up at the house of a journalist who tweeted unflattering things about the local police department. In 2013, a legislative audit in Minnesota found that over half of the state's 11,000 law enforcement officers who use a state driver's license database made searches in that database that appeared questionable. That was excavated by a state audit, and they're trying to deal with that problem. But what face recognition does is it just makes the frailty of the human beings who are law enforcement more dangerous and much more threatening to our safety and to our civil liberties.
We'll go to M, who's calling from Portland. Hi, M. Go ahead.
Hi. I sense in some of this conversation kind of a trend towards accepting that we need this technology at all, that there's kind of innovation is good. I want to question that. I get sold products like a Bluetooth-enabled trash can, which I really don't need, but technology and innovation tells me that that's an option. So I wonder, for the panelists, like, do we even need this? Like, is it so important a technology that we need it at all? And then also, how does this kind of relate to regulating big tech companies and removing the profit motive from harvesting our personal data?
Terry.
Fair question. I don't need a Bluetooth-enabled trash can. I don't need a Bluetooth-enabled gas range to tell me when the gas is on. I agree with the caller that there are reasons. But what you find to be useful may not be or not useful. What one man's trash may be another man's treasure. And it's hard for us to predict or understand how that's going to go. At one point, people thought that people don't need personal computers. People don't need nobody's going to need a portable personal computer. And yet they've become ubiquitous. They've become an enormous part of our lives. The computer you carry in your pocket, which is attached to your radio, which is we call a phone, has become an enormous part of our society. It's difficult to say that we remove profit motive. It's difficult to say that this isn't this isn't that a Bluetooth a ridiculous thing like a Bluetooth enabled trash can is an easy thing to denigrate. It's when the lines get a little bit grayer, where the technology gets some people find it exceedingly useful to keep track of their friends and family using shared address book in the cloud. But I certainly wouldn't want people to mine that for social networks in our society. Where do you draw that line? Who should have access to that data? Those are questions of policy, and they become very fuzzy when you get into those gray areas where some people find them useful and some people don't.
Michael, did you want to add to that?
I would love to. Anne's techno-skepticism is, I think, the absolute right attitude, especially when government surveillance joins with facial recognition. Let me outline one thing that we tell people who ask us to train them on their right to protest. So the Fifth Amendment gives you the right to remain silent. You've heard that over and over. And so let's say you're protesting and you get arrested, and the police want to know who you came to the protest with. They ask you to open your phone and you refuse. They ask you what your password is. You say, I'm exercising my right to remain silent. Well, if you are using a face-activated unlocking system where you just hold the phone up to your face, it's relatively easy for the police to unlock your phone just by holding it up to your face. So you've by adopting the convenience of technology, given your right to access your phone away to law enforcement. And that could carry enormous, horrible consequences for you and your friends. And that's not facial recognition used for surveillance. That's just personal use of facial recognition to enhance a daily convenience. There are lots of devices that are connected to the internet that are supposed to enhance our day-to-day home experience. Well, if these devices are connected to the internet, it also means they can be hacked. And if they can be hacked, it means that there's some potential for the data that's gathered as you move about your life every day to fall into the wrong hands. Techno-skepticism is the absolute right response to this level of convenience that also carries enormous risk.
Thank you so much for your call. We are talking about facial recognition technology on Maine Calling. If you'd like to call in, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Also, if you hurry, you can send in a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Trust for Public Land, inviting you to support their work creating parks and protecting lands with a donation at tpl.org. And Bristol Seafood, a Maine company committed to sustainable fishing practices and partnering with the Marine Stewardship Council.
I'm Sarah Gatcombe from the membership team at Maine Public. And on this day in Maine's history in 1607, 50 colonists left the Popham Colony to return to England. The Popham Colony on the Kennebec River was the first organized attempt to establish a permanent English settlement in the area. Two ships left England on May 31st, 1607, with about 100 colonists and their supplies. In August, they arrived at Pemaquid and ultimately chose Sabino Head at the mouth of the Kennebec for their settlement in what is now the town of Phippsburg. By December, it became clear that neither shelter nor supplies were adequate to serve all the colonists during the coming winter. Happy birthday, Maine!
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Bernstein Scher, Maine Masons, and listeners like you.
I'm Tanya Mosley. Ijeoma Aluo, author of So You Want to Talk About Race, is back, and she's asking us to think deeply about what she calls mediocre white men.
It is not your contributions to society. It's, are you doing better at the end of the day than women or people of color? And that's no way to live. That's no way to think about yourself. There is no self-love in that.
That's next time on Here and Now.
And Here and Now is coming up at noon here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're talking about facial recognition, the pitfalls and potential uses of this technology. Joining me, Michael Kubota of the ACLU of Maine and Terry Yu with UMaine's Computer Science Department. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Going to go to an email here from Ralph. Ralph asks, is it a short step to adapt facial recognition to AI facial profiling? Can my facial photos be compared to many different groups to see if there's a high correlation to predict various behavioral and health characteristics, good and bad? Terry, in healthcare, is there an advantage to facial profiling, facial recognition?
Is it a short step? It is a short step. Is that where people are going to go with it from a healthcare standpoint? Unlikely. I don't know that people's facial profiles are going to lead people to understand more about your health history, more likely your eating habits, more likely your some of the health statistics that they already have access to or could have access to, including your weight, your blood pressure, and other things. Insurance companies have been studying that, and it's not an individual thing in general that the insurance companies will use. What they'll more likely use is large actuarial studies where they're studying all the statistics of large groups of people, and apply it that way. So it is a short step, but it is an unlikely one is how I would probably respond.
All right. I'm going to go to Lisa calling from Orland. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I just have a question about technology itself. You know, you see this opt-out phrases in Facebook and social media, but, you know, as for the technology itself, you know, I would like to have an opt-out option from facial software sign-in and that sort of thing. I just wondered if you've thought about that and, you know.
Yeah. Michael, do you know, are there ways for people today to be opting out?
That's a great question. Our faces are captured and our photos are databased in government servers so ubiquitously and at so many turns that it's extremely difficult to opt out of the system that collects data from you. You can opt out of your personal devices collecting your face information, and you can certainly opt out of social media doing that by just practicing the level of techno-skepticism that M, who called earlier, aired. The bill that's before Congress right now has an opt-out component and has a component where it bans the uses of facial uses of your likeness that are unforeseen by you. So, you know, if you're putting your photo on a social media site, you don't expect that photo to also go to, let's say, Amazon or to another merchandiser or retailer. And so putting those kinds of walls up around the permissible use of photos of you is one direction that the law is going in. And that's a very good and hopeful direction, we think. But Bureau of Motor Vehicles has our photos. We have our photos taken whenever we go through airports. It's very, very difficult to opt out. And that's partly why we think the best approach is to actually just ban government use of facial recognition for law enforcement purposes.
Lisa, thanks for your call. We're going to move on to Alex. Hi, Alex. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yep, go ahead.
Hi, yes, I just had a comment about I think our government should be banning facial recognition for law enforcement and just this use. And, you know, there is really no way to opt out in public, and we're being subjugated by proprietary software. None of us asked for this. It's crept its way in over the years and through end-user license agreements that people just click through, and there needs to be more oversight, and people need to be made aware of the dangers and a good show. And yeah, we're losing agency through the technology that is being put in place around us.
Thanks for your call, Alex. And Terry, I'll turn to you. Losing agency because of the technology around us.
That's certainly true. One of the things that makes my wife doesn't like a phone on her camera, and yet finding a phone these days without a camera is nearly impossible. And so we can cover the cameras on our devices to opt out. On our they make devices, in fact, for stickers or shields to prevent the cameras from being operating on your personal devices without you knowing. But we can ban law enforcement from using such databases, but that doesn't stop Instagram and Facebook. That's bread and butter for Instagram and Facebook, and I would contend that their databases are in some ways far larger than the Department of Motor Vehicles. And it's difficult or impossible to opt out of some of those. If somebody takes a picture of my face at a family gathering, it could be some long-lost relative, some nephew and some niece, and puts it on their Facebook page and identifies everybody in that picture, including their Uncle Terry. Now my face and my name and my identity are tied to a photograph that I may not have a Facebook account or an Instagram account, and yet now my identity and my facial features are associated with that, and they're out there. So
Alex,
opting out is not such a simple thing.
Yeah, thanks for your call. Lucy asks, like to hear the guest's thoughts on potential risk with self-driving cars and the failure to detect dark-skinned pedestrians. This was a study done by the Georgia Institute of Technology in 2019. Do either of the guests have insight on that? Terry, I'm going to go back to you about this one. This is related, isn't it?
It is, and I would submit that we have other technologies that that come to the fore for identifying pedestrians, not just cameras. Cameras would certainly help. We have that technology and command of that technology. But there are other technologies, LIDAR, for instance, which is something like radar, except it uses light beams of light, sort of echoing the light off of things, reflections off things, to find out how distant. It's the same technology might be used in speed traps, speed detection, radar detectors, light detectors for this. And using a broad spectrum or a broad scan of LIDAR in front of your vehicle would help you identify people regardless of what color their skin or what clothes they are wearing.
All right, we'll go to Andrew, who's calling from Kittery. Hi, Andrew, go ahead.
Hey, I'm a physician and rheumatologist, and I'm fascinated by your talk. I'm working with a bloodless diagnostics on the cloud, and one of the things that's being looked at is electrical signals giving diagnostic information, and one thing considered is facial recognition. I think the listeners might be interested in when you're in medical school, especially when you get to residency, you develop this sixth sense to distinguish between sick and not sick as you're walking through the ICU. It's kind of spooky, but by the time you've been trained enough, you really see it. And what most of us physicians are wondering is, what exactly did quantify did we see? And we're wondering, is it smell, appearance, pallor, that type of thing. And facial recognition is actually something we think we can use to identify those who are having impending illnesses. Probably not a lot different than a dog, telling that your diabetes is out of control.
Andrew, that's so interesting. What do you think you're looking at? Are you looking at skin color, veins in the eyes? I mean, what are the kinds of things that are being studied there?
Well, it's just in its infancy, but we all know we can do it. The question is, can we work with the right kind of folks, maybe it's Silicon Valley or elsewhere, to help us pin down exactly what it is we're recognizing when we stop at that, maybe room number 3 instead of room number 5, 6, or 7, and say, spend a little extra time and we discover, there was a real problem here in the ICU, and I'm glad we stopped. It is an interesting sixth sense that physicians develop in their training.
Thank you so much for calling. Calling in. And I want to have both Terry and Michael talk to your thoughts on that. Terry, is this kind of research something you're familiar with?
Yes. And in fact, people at NVIDIA are doing similar work on understanding the dimensions of human characteristics. Let me also try not to unconflate inflate. the difference between computer vision and facial recognition. Facial recognition is part of computer vision. You might not be looking at somebody's face, but in fact their motions, if their motions are erratic, if their head is drooping, it's not about their face, it's about other human characteristics at that point. And so we've been using computer vision to study the body's posture, and not just their face, for instance. So it's a broader topic that we're speaking of there. But yes, that sort of thing happens all the time, trying to figure out a gait analysis and determine if the person is showing early signs of Parkinson's, for instance, foot drag or something like that, would be something about the way they walk rather than what their face looks like.
And Michael, what are your thoughts about use of this technology in medicine?
It's fascinating, but dramatically above my pay grade.
Okay, fair enough. Thanks so much for calling, Andrew. A tweet here from Todd. The problem is that we don't own the rights to our digital identity. Maybe we can copyright our digital image. Michael, I'll turn to you for that one.
Well, that is very interesting. The overall point is you may be able to get a copyright for your face, but that presumes resources. And we all know that we live in a highly unequal society where half of Boehners can't come up with $400 cash. And so although theoretically that proposition is interesting, in practice, it's not available to the vast majority of people. And so, just a small number of people with disposable income may be able to push back against the growing facial recognition state, but a very, very small number.
And Terry, what are your final thoughts? We just have a few seconds about this coming year and what kind of legislation might be unfolding around this?
Only that it's always true that that policy lags behind technology. Technology, we invent cell phones, but we don't actually know all the things we're going to use them for, and it always lags behind. Contrary to any position that somebody may think I'm taking, I actually applaud the exploration of new policy and policy design, privacy and privacy control, because we have to do it intelligently. My concern is that a ban, as I said before, is a blunt instrument. So knowing, encouraging it, and yet making sure that we do it in such a way that it benefits society, we can take the most benefit from the technology, is where I would like to see it go.
All right. Well, we are out of time. I really appreciate both of you being here. And I know that we will probably be returning to this topic again and again, facial recognition technology. Thank you both. Terry Yu, Associate Professor of Computer Science at the University of Maine, and Michael Kubota, Policy Counsel with the ACLU of Maine. Today's sound engineer was Lucy Suchek. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.